morning.
Good morning.
That didn't sound really excitable.
Well, I'm only one cup in, so okay. This is what you get.
Alrighty. Fair enough. Fair enough. Mm-hmm. Well, hi, everyone. It's Greg and James. If you didn't know that, you're in the wrong place.
What are we going to talk about today?
Oh, we've got a whole bunch of stuff today. We're going to bounce around on a few topics.
But let me guess, housekeeping comes first.
Housekeeping. Yes. Always housekeeping. Mm-hmm. I love it. We need a housekeeping theme song.
I'll see what I can find.
Okay. Something very 60s sitcom, you know.
You bet.
Housekeeping. Mm-hmm. So, two new patrons, Paul Beats and Chad Meigs. I'm sure I butchered both of your names. Thank you so much for supporting Hopnology.
Yeah, thank you.
We appreciate it. And Chad in particular came at us with a half a dozen questions right on the private Patreon page. So if you want to know about all the things he asked about and all the answers we gave, you need to be a patron.
Please.
Let's see. Big announcement from the Hopnology team.
Big.
We are going to go ahead and do our first live webinar, workshop, class, however you want to define it. And right now we're looking at February 22nd. So write that down on your calendars, February 22nd. Let's see. James, you did all the math on the time here.
Yeah, so, I used my fingers.
Oh, boy. He's got an abacus there.
Mm-hmm.
Since we know that we have folks that listen from all over the world, we're going to do this on a Saturday. Saturday for North America. Right. Saturday, 5 o'clock Central Standard Time. That is noon on Sunday if you're with our friends in New Zealand. And, we've given you two data points. You can figure out the timing if you're in between those two places.
Right. Exactly.
So we'll have signups and the topics that we're going to review come January. There'll be something special for our patrons. So another plug there for our Patreon page. And we're looking forward to having a nice discussion and going deeper into some of the topics that we can't necessarily do on a podcast because it will be a live webinar. There'll be visuals. There'll be take-homes. And yep. We're very excited about being able to get to the point now where we can present some of this stuff to you in a deeper fashion. More deeper.
More deeper.
More deeper. I haven't even started my first cup of coffee, so I have an excuse.
Wow.
Okay, there's some coffee. That's better. So keep an eye out for that. There will be more information going forward. Just a note, next week, which if we're dropping these episodes in the right order, next week will be the 30th, we are going to take a skip week. We have never taken a skip week.
We have not.
Which I'm very proud of us for. We've been doing this for 9 months now, I think.
Ever is and the for, answer, yeah.
And ever, and yep. ever. And this will be our first skip week. So the 30th of December, the week between Christmas and Hanukkah and New Year's, no one's in the car listening to podcasts. You're all off with your families anyway or mm-hmm. sitting at home. So there will be no new episode, but we will be back in January. All right. That's housekeeping.
That's it.
Cue housekeeping exit music.
Nice. I like that. Thanks for the marker.
Okay, good. You'll put that in. All right. Something interesting happened this week in Michigan. Only one thing.
That's it.
Just one thing.
Yep. What happened in Michigan?
So Big Lake Brewing in Michigan, who are one of the fastest growing breweries in the country, they added a logo to their beer. They already were using the Brewers Association Independent Craft logo, which mm-hmm. we have on our website. Mm-hmm. We're members. They added a Michigan-only brewery logo. And the idea there is they're brewing in Michigan, and they're only distributing in Michigan.
Hmm.
And they're in stores, they're in bars, and they are a very quickly growing, recognized by the Brewing Association as one of the fastest growing breweries in the country. And they went out there and said, we are all about Michigan. So why is that interesting?
Yeah, because I'm thinking New Glarus has been doing that for 20 years.
Mm-hmm. And New Glarus is an outstanding operation, but a rarity
yes.
in that they are certainly large enough and certainly well-regarded enough that they could easily expand beyond their Wisconsin footprint,
mm-hmm.
but they've made the choice not to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So all this talk that we have about business and about growing, What makes a brewery or any other company for that matter decide, you know what, I'm going to be the best I can be in this radius, in this bubble, and I'm declaring flat out, I'm not going any further than that. So what's the benefit there, and what's the risk? I mean, the benefit to me is goodwill, is good local goodwill.
Mm-hmm.
And also you're creating scarcity.
Right.
I mean, look, every time I visit you in Wisconsin, I go to get on the plane and I can pick up a 12-pack of Moon Man in the airport at the gate.
Well, so scarcity is one thing. And if they're your earlier comment about this brewery being one of the fastest growing breweries, they get more mileage out of that Michigan only thing, as opposed to, you know, Joe Schmo and their nano brewery, who are likely all Michigan too, but
have no choice.
Have no choice, right? So that was my, when I saw that article, I'm like, what's this all about? But then I'm thinking, the first thing I thought of when I saw it wasn't about distribution. It was about, are they using all Michigan grown ingredients? Is that what that seal means?
And it's not.
No, at all. Because I'm like, where are they getting their malting barley from in Michigan? And where that, you know, who's, or maybe they're using a distributor that's in Michigan for their, but it has nothing to do with it. So that immediately confused me. This is the world we live in, you and I. So I'm always looking at the ingredients and less so about the marketing decision to say, you know what, we're only doing this in Michigan. I don't understand why. Same thing with New Glarus. You know, like you said, they have the opportunity to expand beyond their borders, and they could do so with great fanfare. But, you know, they're saying, well, we want to keep it at the scale we are because so we can focus on quality and X, Y, and Z. Mm-hmm. But for these other new startup breweries that don't have that pedigree, what's the play there?
Yeah, and how do you backpedal if you get to the point where you change your mind on that?
True.
Because you do that at a great risk of your reputation.
And investment in, you know, if they're using pre-printed cans. Mm-hmm. And now you've got cans out in the marketplace and you're no longer just distributing in Michigan and you're going beyond your borders. Is that a label violation? I don't know.
Well, and it's interesting because it's one thing when you put the Brewers Association logo on there because that is controlled by another entity. Mm-hmm. I believe the Michigan only brewery logo, I could be wrong, I think that's something Big Lake created.
Probably.
So they can change what that means at any moment.
That's true. That's true. Yeah, I don't know. It
bears watching to see if other folks go that route. And of course, you know, New Glarus is the example. Even in the comments on the first article I read on this on Big Lake, the third comment was, well, the Carries have been doing this for years, mm-hmm. in Wisconsin, and, you know, they're a standard to live by, and they are. But it's to your point, they would have to just make a decision, and they've already got canning and bottling and distribution to be, mm-hmm. able to have those trucks go over the border to the, right. next state would take zero effort.
Mm-hmm.
It's a choice.
It is, and I don't see it adding value unless your beer is good enough to be sought after.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you've got mediocre beer or you're chasing the current market trends and that's what your brewery's based around,
Yeah. Right?
To me, I don't I just don't see it.
I don't get it either. And so Big Lake opened in 2013. They're expanding this year to 7,000 barrels. Again, they're being recognized as one of the larger and faster growing breweries.
7,000 barrels? That's it?
That's it.
Now I give a double meh because I'm like, really, 7,000 barrels?
Mm-hmm.
And you're not distributing out of Michigan? Well, no duh. You don't have enough volume, yeah. to get out of Michigan. You know, it'd be one thing if they're right on the border and they're like, we're not putting it over there at that stop and go.
Which we can see from the tap room.
Exactly. I don't know. It's
curious.
It seems disingenuous to me, but whatever.
Yeah, and you know, we have also, lived through the local phenomenon, and we've talked about it many times, and that you so want that to mean something in the purchase price and in the goodwill that, hey, it's the local, it's the local, it's the local. And it doesn't.
No.
So they're really banking on the fact that they're saying, we're Michigan only, you know, be Michigan proud. They're banking on that, giving them enough incremental business that they don't have to go beyond the borders.
Right.
Be Michigan. It's a risk.
Be Michigan proud. Buy Michigan beer, but yet we're going to make this beer with smash mouth hops that come from the Pacific Northwest instead of patronizing our local growers. That's why, yeah, I think it's disingenuous, right? It's convenient. It's convenient for these groups to identify as local and having all this great pride in being, in this case, in Michigan, but yet they fall flat, abjectly flat, when it comes to utilizing and supporting the resources that are right in their backyard. Mm-hmm. And so that's why I find it a bit hypocritical.
Yeah, I don't disagree. I don't disagree. I find it curious.
Right.
Curious, and I don't know what they expect to get out of it.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a marketing play, and that's about it.
Yeah.
And we'll have to see if they continue to use it or continue to have that logo mean the same thing in years to come.
Right. I'd like to see them stick behind their decision on being Michigan proud when they're at 70,000 barrels. Let's see how that treats them.
Yeah. So that's what happened in Michigan this week.
Anything else I can shit all over?
I don't know. I don't know. I'm sure we can think of something.
Yeah, it'll come up, I'm sure.
Oh, I've got one.
Okay.
We didn't talk about this before we started. There's a new epidemic, I'm going to call it, in tap rooms that I've noticed recently.
That they're empty?
Quite the opposite. Quite the opposite. There is something that is pervasive in tap rooms everywhere I've gone. I ended up in two tap rooms last Saturday. That's a long story.
Imagine that.
A cidery, which was quite nice, was one of them. But there's a trend I keep seeing, and I've actually talked to a couple of brewers who aren't crazy about the trend either, but it's something you see in every single tap room you go into. Can you guess what it is?
Well, like I said, the thing that we notice around here in the wintertime is that the traffic is about 50% less, but I don't know. What is it?
Strollers.
Ah, strollers, yes.
The number of children I saw running around tap rooms, little children. I have children, and I don't bring them to tap rooms because that's my place.
Mm-hmm.
A place by me recently put up a bunch of signs basically saying you need to watch your kids.
Wow.
Because they run around like crazy people.
Wow. We do not see that here in the Midwest. Absolutely not. I mean, I don't know what they do in Ohio, but certainly.
No one knows what they do in Ohio.
Yeah, certainly in my neck of the woods. No, you don't see that. The only time you see that is like if there's in the summertime and the brewery happens to have like an outdoor venue. You know, kids can run around or they can bring their dogs or what have you. But like in the tap room, no, we rarely see that. Thank goodness.
I'm seeing it more and more. And it speaks to the popularity of getting out and going to a tap room. But people are bringing their children and letting them loose.
Yeah. That would definitely not fly around here.
Interesting. Okay.
Ugh. It gives me shivers. I don't even like to think about that.
And again, I have children. I like children, but I don't want them near my flight.
Right. Well, it's like, okay, yeah, mommy and daddy or daddy and daddy and whoever are going in to have a drink at the tap room. And what do? You go there to talk and you go there to enjoy beer, just have good times with your friends and fellow neighbors. Not mind your children.
Mm-hmm. Well, right. And that's what's happening. They're not minding their children.
Right. So how about this? Be a parent. Take them to the park. Do whatever you're going to do. But when it comes time to go and have your alcoholic beverages, leave the kids at home.
The first brewery that can come up with a bouncy house shaped like a brew kettle. I'm then you'll have changed my mind that, yes, there's a place for kids at the tap room.
Yeah, it is a shifting marketplace, and it's shifting rapidly.
Yeah.
That goes along with a story I was reading earlier this week about the way craft breweries and tap rooms have to evolve. The next big thing isn't going to be hard seltzers for, you know, and other, like, brewables in order to expand a tap room's market. It's going to be more inclusive of their neighborhood community. So maybe that's what you're seeing. Maybe you're Could seeing, be. You know, hey, let's make it friendly for everybody to come here. Well, you're just going to end up driving old crotchety curmudgeons like me to the dark corner bar, so he can have his, you know, Pilsner in peace. And maybe that's what they're trying to do. Great, knock themselves out. But yeah, I don't like that either.
And I'm making a note here because when I do retire and go into second career and I open my bar, mm-hmm. it's going to be called the Dark Corner Bar.
Dark Corner Bar, yep.
I like it.
Nice.
I like it. So anyway, I sorry to spring that one on you out of nowhere, but it's been bugging me.
Yeah, that drives me nuts.
Yeah. All right, so you wanted to talk about leaves and stuff.
You want to talk about actual important stuff now? Is that what you mean?
We're going to leave this topic and move on to the next one.
Oh, nice. Yeah. Yeah, you'll have to come up with all sorts of creative rhymes around this. Yeah, I wanted to talk about, we've been in the past, I don't know how many episodes, we've talked about applications. So we've talked about sprayers and we've talked about various, you know, whether you're organic or conventional and different chemicals, insecticides, fungicides, fertilizers, but we've never really talked about spray technology. And this is something that I was in charge of, application technology for the ag chem company that I worked for years ago. And just looking at what is the best way to deliver whatever particular compound we're spraying. And that's, you know, what type of sprayer are you using? What's the nozzle type? What's the droplet shape? What's the formulation in order to get this material, this chemical into the plant, if it's supposed to go in, or maybe it's supposed to be on the surface. So this idea of just, you know, putting stuff in your tank and spraying it, it doesn't, and you feeling good about getting it on there, it doesn't stop there. It's a bunch of decisions one has to make in order to configure their system correctly to get the biggest bang for their buck. I've seen folks applying chemicals, conventional and organic, to control various things, and they're just not getting the control. And it's not because they're not timing things right and they're using the right concentrations. It's that their rig isn't set up correctly. They don't have the right nozzles. They don't have the right droplet size. They don't have the right, we call them adjuvants. So they're additives to the tank to change the properties of the liquid so that it actually gets into the plant. So I just wanted to talk, you know, as much as time will allow here, about the biggies, the things that we have to look for and understand when we're spraying. So that's what I want to talk about.
Did you say droplet size matters?
Droplet size matters.
Wow. I'm legitimately right. impressed that it's that detailed. And yes, that does give me lots of ideas for an Instagram post.
And not only does droplet size matter, the shape of the droplet matters and whether or not it's got an air bubble in the middle of it. So, yeah. and surface tension matters. So let's think about it like this. If you take just a drop of water, how about this? You got an apple and you're going to wash your apple off. So you wash your apple and just with water, no soap, no nothing. And the water beads up on the surface, just like water beads up on the surface of like a waxed car, right? Mm-hmm. And all plants on their surface, whether it's on the fruit surface, flower surface, leaf surface, are covered in wax, cuticle wax. And this is wax. It's sort of like beeswax and candle wax, really long chain carbon waxes. It makes a pretty good barrier. That's why we use wax to seal things up, right? It stops the plant from losing moisture just through its leaves all over the place. It's sort of like our skin, right? It keeps all the juices in. So if we want to get something into the plant, a chemical into the plant through its leaves, we have to get it through that wax. that's the challenge of spray technology. How do you get stuff through the wax without stripping the wax off the leaves and then the leaf dries out? Hmm. Because we can see that, like we talked about burn down herbicides, where like people, yep. and we spray it on the lower part of the plant and the leaves dry out. Well, what you're doing really is you're stripping the cuticle, that wax off the leaf. That's one way to do it. And the leaf dries out, dries up, falls off. We don't want to do that when we don't want to do that, right? So there's things that we do to change the attributes of the spray droplet in order to get it to do what we want. So the first thing we do is, let's say you're spraying for spider mites. And spider mites, these tiny, teeny, tiny little mites, you really can't see with your eye, naked eye, but you can see their webbing sometimes. Well, if you have just a droplet of water and you're going to spray it on there, and let's say you get good coverage, the web and the tiny little hairs on the leaf of the plant that you can't see, these droplets have a very high surface tension, right? That's what forms them into droplets. And they can't hit the leaf and like smear out, right? We call that wetting. So they're going to want to stay in these little droplets. And if they stay in a little droplet, you're not hitting the mites. You're not hitting the eggs. They just stay in little droplets. So what we want to do is we want to wet the leaf out. So we add something to the tank mix to get that surface tension to break it so it wets. That would be akin to like putting soap in your water when you're washing an apple. So if you add soapy water to the surface of an apple, the water doesn't bead up. It sort of forms a film around the apple. You follow me?
I do follow. I guess my question would be, if you're spraying for spider mites, you're buying something to add to your water to specifically spray for spider mites, why wouldn't that already have what it needs in order to spread properly?
Good question. And it usually comes down to formulation. So those chemicals, they're formulated to, you know, be active, whatever it is. But then they don't know what your scenario is. You may have a different type of plant that doesn't require wetting in order to spray spider mites or aphids or whatever it happens to be. So they're not going to formulate into their base chemical mixture. They're not going to formulate a wetting agent. They're going to have you add it to your mix if your situation requires it. So in hops, usually the answer is yes, you do want something that allows this liquid to sheet, form a film, right? And those are called wetters or spreaders. Some of them are silicone-based. Many of them are oil-based. Sometimes they're called horticultural oils. They're like emulsified oils. You're like, well, wait a minute, you can't add oil to water. Well, you can if you put an emulsifier in it. That's what like your soap is. You put, you know, Dawn takes grease out of your way or whatever it's called.
Speaking of soap, if you still need a holiday gift, Mark at Mountain View Hops and his hop soaps.
Mark, you better.
I'm going to make him a sponsor if he kills
Mark,
me.
Mark, you better up your Patreon support. right. So the first thing we think about is, what are we adding to our spray chemicals in order to change the way the water droplets, the liquid droplets, interact with the leaf? And in some cases, you don't want spreaders, right? Because you're like, well, if I make it really slick with a bunch of silicone in there, it's just going to run off my plant, right? Well, it can. So now application volume becomes important. So you've got stuff that's really slippery. It's going to coat your plant really well, so you should need less liquid. Oh, right. And so if I'm using less liquid, but my chemical concentration doesn't change, so I put, you know, the same amount of chemical in on per acre or per hectare, but I'm using less liquid, then the concentration of that active chemical in whatever hits the leaf is going to be much higher. Uh-huh. Exactly. So you see where you get sort of this delicate dance going on.
Damn math.
And so that's for one scenario. That's for like applying to get good sheeting coverage over a leaf, which you may want to do for something like mildew control. If you want to get all these spores that are floating around, get those things covered with spray material. But that's maybe not something you want to do if you're using a systemic chemical to get inside of the plant. So I talked about stuff that, you know, things that you can spray to get treatment on the outside for whatever. But what if you want to get stuff inside? What if you want to treat the plant systemically with an insecticide or a fungicide? Or what if you want to get micronutrients, foliarly applied micronutrients into the plant? Now we got to get it through this cuticle. And that's not such an easy thing. The formulation chemists that build these mixtures think about it. And the way they do that is there are certain compounds in that mixture that increase what's called the driving force. It's the amount of energy, chemical energy, that's in this droplet that allows it to basically dissolve in through the cuticle or find its way through these little fractures in the leaf cuticle to get inside the plant. In some cases, it's formulated to go in through the little openings on the leaf surface that are the plant uses for gas exchange. Those are called stomata. As a droplet dries on the plant, water's leaving, but the chemical staying behind, the concentration of that chemical keeps increasing and increasing and increasing in that droplet to a very critical threshold. Because if it loses too much moisture, it starts to crystallize and dry, and then it becomes inactive. It can't actually get in the plant. So this droplet is losing water, and the chemical concentration is increasing to the point where the driving force is getting higher and higher and higher. It's able to sort of overcome the wax and work its way into the leaf until it loses too much water, goes off a cliff, and then it becomes inactive.
And I would imagine certain other chemicals, you lose too much water, they become much too concentrated and can burn or kill the plant.
Absolutely. You'll see that a lot of times when we talk about our hop yard flashcards, you know, when you're quizzing me. And sometimes, you know, when I'm asking questions or people will send pictures, they'll say, oh, I've got a virus, or oh, this is downy mildew. And it's like, no, that looks like spray toxicity. Which is, yeah, if your concentration is off in your droplet, or your solution isn't mixed well, so that you get pockets of high and low concentration of chemicals, you can actually burn the leaf pretty badly, because you're trying to, those formulations are made so you can have that driving force to push its way through the leaf cuticle to get into the plant. In some cases, some of these adjuvants I talked about, the things that we add to our spray mixture in order to change its properties, sometimes you want the compounds to stay put. You don't want them to run off the leaf, right? They have to stay put because they take a certain amount of time for that driving force to build to get into the plant. So then we have things that we call stickers or penetrants. And usually they're chemicals that are, some of them are made from things like tree sap, like pine sap. Some of them are made from other fats, so fatty acids. You can think of it sort of like glue. So it's going to stick the spray droplet to the leaf and keep it there and allow it to dissolve into the leaf cuticle. And some of those penetrant chemicals actually help to melt the wax on the leaf so that the stuff can get in, but then not so much that it loses its wax and causes a dead spot. So it's really touchy there about whether you've got the right concentration of sticker or penetrant in your mix. You know, all of these things, all of these adjuvants and different spray techniques are things we have to consider if we are we getting the right performance out of our spray applications. If you're like, I keep spraying this stuff, James, and I just don't see a difference. Well, it doesn't mean that the prescription was incorrect. It may be something just as simple as, and I say simple, as we've just talked about it, is not. It's something as singular as what is your spray rig set up to do, right? Are you out there hosing chemical on with a wand sprayer and it's just running off all over the place? Then you're putting on too much liquid and the concentration in your spray may be too low. Maybe your droplet size is way, way too fine. And if you're in a high heat, low humidity scenario, it could very well be evaporating and you're just blowing powder out there. And so it's not going to be active when it hits the leaf. So those are things that people don't often think about when they're building their spray program.
Huh. And I have to imagine that given the different the different rates and all these things you're talking about, it's extremely complicated to try and do multiple things at once. I mean, you can't really apply nutrients and spider mite control and mildew control all at the same time because of the different concentrations and the balances you have to maintain.
You know one of my favorite sayings, Greg.
It depends.
Yeah, and you can do whatever you want. Well, let's be honest. There's the optimal application scenario for any given compound. At the University of Mother Nature, we have to make compromises. And one of those compromises is the cost of application. How many times do you want to be running your equipment through the field? So there's an actual literal cost to your equipment time and your labor time, but there's also an environmental cost of running through the field time and time again and compacting your soil and doing all these other sorts of things. So we have to make trade-offs. So that's sort of the operational answer to that. Yeah. But there are some things that you absolutely do not want to apply together, because when chemicals combine, in some cases they create toxic issues for the plant. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't want to be applying copper fertilizer with this fungicide because it makes an excellent defoliant.
this is why you get a pesticide applicator's license, so you learn these things.
Exactly, correct. So, and learn how to read labels. So, but there are some things that you do want to apply together, right? So in some cases, like micronutrients may be applied with a certain type of, you know, other chemical that improves the absorption of that stuff into the leaf. But like I said just a minute ago, it's also equally likely that it says absolutely under penalty of death, do not apply micronutrients with this compound. So you have to read the label. I am a big proponent of stacking up as much as I can for any given spray, just because it's much more efficient. Mm-hmm. for those of us in the commercial side of things. But, you know, I don't want to go out and make a run through today because I need to spray for mites, I need to spray for fungus, and I need to put on micronutrients. I'm not making three trips.
Right.
So now I have to pick basically what gets me the biggest bang for my buck here, and understanding that the settings I choose to go with and the adjuvants I choose to use are probably not optimized for all three, but it's, you know, the best I can do for a combination spray.
And understanding, especially at a very basic level, what over and under dilution means. I mean, the spider mites being a great example, that if you see no reaction at all from spraying, you could have too much water in the mix relative. Mm-hmm. You could also have too little. Right. Whereas, you know, you need to understand what the impacts will be so that if things don't work, you can make your adjustments.
Right. And in some cases, typically in the too little case, you're just going to piss them off. I see this a lot too, where folks are concerned about using conventional chemicals. And they say, well, I'm only going to use half the concentration because half is less bad. No, actually, half is worse.
Because you're poking the bear.
You're poking the bear. You are exposing those, in this case, we're talking about spider mites, you're exposing those mites to low levels of a non-lethal dose, they're going to build a resistance. Oh. And now, when you go on with your full-strength chemical, when it becomes a real problem, you can't kill them. Do follow the label. It's there for a reason. And if you don't like the conventional approach, then, you know, look to organic methods. But understand all these variables we talked about have an impact in the performance of whatever you are spraying.
I find it fascinating that you can piss them off and get them just more agitated. I think there's an agriculturally themed horror movie in planning there.
There probably have been with Charlton Heston, Erdens Borgnine. Mm-hmm. Something about giant ants. I don't know. Yeah, so I thought I'd just share that little nugget of wisdom with folks that, you know, it's not just about putting your whatever liquid that you want to spray in a tank with water and going out and spraying it. That many times the label will say must be applied with a surfactant. And a surfactant is just basically there to break the surface tension of the liquid. It must be applied with a crop oil concentrate. Crop oil concentrate is an emulsified oil, so it's basically oil mixed with some sort of soap-like material, so that it actually coats the leaf and aids in penetration of the compound. It must be applied in droplets no bigger or bigger than X in some cases. So then it's like, well, now how do I change my droplet size? Well, that's all about the pressure you're spraying at and the nozzle you're using. In some cases, you have different penetration. You'd love the fact that you keep saying penetration.
I do. Uh-huh. I do. I'm trying so hard not to be difficult about it.
So you've got this crazy leaf canopy, right? And how do you make sure you get droplets and liquid all around that leaf? Well, one of the ways we do that is by basically blasting in a fog from an air blast sprayer in order to make sure we're getting full coverage on that leaf. But if it's super dry and it's hot and you've got a very fine mist coming out as a fog, it may actually dry in the air before it gets good coating on your leaf. So now you need bigger droplets. So how are you going to do that, right? You can do that with different nozzle sizes. You can do that with different nozzle types. And you can add what are called drift retardants. So basically they make bigger droplets. You can add that to your solution. So lots of options there.
Huh. And, you know, the number one rule with all of this stuff is, and you've said it half a dozen times, read the label.
Mm-hmm.
Just read the damn label.
Oh, and it's boring, you know, as hell, too. But all the information
is
there.
You need a dictionary, I think, as you're reading the label, based on some of the words you're making up, mm-hmm, as we go along, mm-hmm, here.
Yep. Absolutely.
But, yeah, I mean, we've said this before about every aspect of production of anything. When your neighbor says, oh, yeah, I use this, go ahead and spray a couple of, you know, this many gallons on this much area, don't just go ahead and do it. Read the damn label.
Yep. Read the label. Understand your sprayer setup. Why you're doing what you're doing, and if you don't know, ask.
I think you've washed much knowledge over us here.
Ah, nice. Yes,
that was a stretch.
That was a stretch. Yeah, it was bad.
I tried. Reminders: keep your eyes open for the live session we're going to do in February 22nd. Put it on your calendars. And next week, no podcast next week. I'll probably still Instagram and bug you all that way. But we're going to take the week off.
Use it as homework to go back and listen to some of our earlier podcasts.
Ooh, that's a good idea. And invite your friends to listen with you. If you're having a New Year's Eve party, playing a couple of our podcasts in the background instead of some of this tired music that's coming out these days from all those young folk, as we put on our old man hat, mm-hmm, I think some Hopnology podcast mixtape is the way to go for your New Year's Eve party.
Totally. You love the fact that you keep saying penetration.